Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. The popularity of cell phones is ever increasing, but the bandwidth or wireless spectrum they depend on is not. So it's up to researchers like iCor professor Dr. Norman Beaulieu to figure out how to squeeze more space out of what he says is a finite spectrum resource. And endangered bull trout are making a bit of a comeback in the Clearwater River. That's the good news from a study conducted by Mike Roetke of the Alberta Conservation Association. And Corey Rasmussen is another ACA biologist from Rocky Mountain House who's spending his winter pumping life-saving air into frozen lakes in an effort to save some rainbow trout. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. One of the world's leading researchers in wireless communications is Dr. Norman Beaulieu of the University of Alberta. His work was featured in Time magazine last August, and now he's been awarded the U of A's Gordon Kaplan Award for Research Excellence. Norman holds both a Canada Research Chair and an iCor Chair in broadband wireless communications. His research focuses on how to make the most efficient use of a finite resource, what he refers to as bandwidth and spectrum. And even if you don't know what it is, you use it every time you call someone on your cell phone.
Perhaps the best way to explain what spectrum is to give an example. If you consider your FM radio receiver, there's a dial, and the dial runs from 88 megahertz to 108 megahertz. So that is bandwidth. The bandwidth is the frequencies on which the radio stations are sending their messages and their music and their information. Now, cell phone users also have to be using a piece of the spectrum. They have to be using bandwidth. And therein lies the challenge and the research that I'm involved with is as you have more and more users, they will need more and more bandwidth in order to be able to have the services that they want. But in fact, the bandwidth that we have is finite. There isn't additional bandwidth. So the challenge that we face in our research is to be able to put more and more users into the same bandwidth as more and more users want some service. That is, in fact, complicated or exacerbated by the fact that the individual user also wants more services. A person, in addition to having a cell phone service, would like to have WiMAX or would like to be able to do web browsing while they're sitting on the bus, etc. So what we're concerned with is providing all of these services to users and growing numbers of users at the same time that the bandwidth we have available to support the services is finite. This means that we have to develop new technologies that will allow more users to use the same bandwidth.
How do you do that without forcing people to conserve, in a sense, the services that they're using?
Perhaps an analogy we could use here is that of a person listening to three conversations at the same time but focusing on one. We, in fact, in some ways try to mimic that in the signal processing, the technology that we have. We take multiple users, we put them on the same frequencies, the same bandwidth, at the same time, and then we develop technologies or signal processing ways of separating out the users we don't want to hear. That is successful. There's the technology called CDMA, Code Division Multiple Access, that's used in cell phones in North America and Japan, in fact, does do that. It puts multiple users into the same frequency spectrum at the same time and then separates out the desired user by means of a signal processing code. Hence the name Code Division Multiple Access. We're not as good as that yet as, in fact, as the human brain, which can separate the conversations. But, in fact, that's actually quite a parallel situation, is that we are putting all the people together in the same bandwidth time space, if you like. You can think of bandwidth as an alternative dimension to time. So we have a time bandwidth space, and we're putting all the users there at the same time and letting them interfere with each other and then developing better and better ways to cancel out the interference.
How do you actually do that, cancel out the interference?
Well, for example, in a code division multiple access system, you multiply the total signal by a particular signal, and that signal has the effect of reinforcing the signal that you want and canceling out the others. Another way to come at it is if you can make the other people's signals look noise-like to the user, So it looks like a little bit of added noise to the other users rather than other users. So, in fact, instead of hearing a second conversation, what you hear is a little bit of extra hiss, as it were. And the signal processing techniques we use in CDMA, for example, affect that. Everybody gets a little bit of extra hiss on their signal, but we have many, many more people using the same time bandwidth resources.
What is it that you're working on in your lab?
We're focusing quite a bit of effort now on what's called ultra-wideband radio, which is the newest and hottest topic in wireless. The concept here is to spread the signal over even wider bandwidth than we did with CDMA. So we occupy gigahertz of bandwidth, which means that the signal has a very low amount of energy in any particular part of the spectrum. Then you can use ultra-wideband radio as a multiple access technique and lay it on top of other services, because the other services only see a little bit of extra noise because the amount of noise that they see is proportional to the amount of bandwidth that they use. So if we spread the energy in an ultra-wideband signal across 1,000 times or 1,000,000 times the bandwidth of another signal, they only see 1/1,000,000th of the energy in our signal, which is usually imperceivable. Now, UWB is a new technology, and as I say, it occupies a huge bandwidth, so there's a lot of issues about how do we synchronize such signals, how do we shape the pulses that we use for digital transmission and such signals. There's a lot of challenging topics there, and it's intended for unlicensed operation, and recently the FCC in the U.S. has granted the licenses for it, so we'll see licensing following in a number of other countries. So we're getting a bit of a jump here in the sense that we're working on the technology before it's actually been licensed, but it's not very far ahead in the future.
Do you have a lot of competition in this area?
Well, there's a lot of people doing a lot of research, both at universities and in industries, right? So you have university-based researchers in how many countries in the world? It must be hundreds. You have industrial-based researchers in a lot of prominent industrialized countries. So there's a lot of competition. Research is competitive. And ideas are important. Everybody's looking for good ideas. And then it's not just enough to have the idea. You have to be able to develop the idea. Formulating the problem is an important part of research. What is the problem exactly? And if I can describe the problem very well, then I have better hope of being able to find a solution to the problem. But the first step is problem formulation. Then the step is what is the solution? And then what's the applicability of it? You want to be finding solutions that are relevant because you can implement them. And in the end, engineering is an applied science, and applied science is about improving the quality of life. That means you have the squeeze bottle for ketchup now. That means you have computers now. That means that you have cell phones now. But we want to make all of those services, and in particular in my case, the wireless services, better than they are.
Why do you think wireless has become so important to our lives?
It's convenience. Right? It's convenient to be able to place a cell phone call from wherever you are. It's, in fact, more than convenient because in the case of an emergency. If your car breaks down, you can now dial for road assistance from your cell phone. Ultimately, it's convenience and quality of life. It's contributing to that.
You're from Vancouver. You could be doing your wireless work anywhere. What brought you to Alberta?
Well, I grew up in Vancouver, and I did degrees at the University of British Columbia. Subsequent to that, I went to Queen's University because that was an opportunity. There was a good appointment there. I took a Queen's National Scholar position at Queen's. And then the ICOR institution was established in Alberta, which was intended to bring leading researchers in information technology areas into Alberta. And there was a great opportunity here. ICOR has given me an ICOR research chair and a lot of facilities and resources to do research at the very leading edge. So I came to Alberta directly as a result of the resources and opportunities that were offered to me by the ICOR research chair.
With the lab that you have set up here, who else involved in that?
Well, I'm certainly not doing all this research on my own. I have a number of graduate students, about 18, and the graduate students are here for training, but they're an integral part of the work, and it's quite a rewarding experience to work with keen graduate students who contribute often their own ideas and solutions to these problems that we work on in our research. And I'm very pleased to be able to have a lab with 18 keen grad students in it. We have students from around the world, actually. There are students from Alberta, students from Ontario, and students from China and Iran and Czechoslovakia. And we have a happy little group up there, which Our activities include going to barbecues on Friday afternoon on the North Saskatchewan River.
You've done very well because just recently you've won the Aztec Award for the work that you've been doing in wireless technology. You have Stacey Fellowships, you've got a Canada Research Chair, and now you've been presented with the Gordon Kaplan Award for Research Excellence, and you're going to be giving a lecture. What's the message that you want to get across in your award lecture?
First, let me say that I'm very pleased to be named the recipient of the Kaplan Award. I think there's a lot of very deserving candidates for this award. And it's a special award in the sense that it's for the entire university community. So people are looking at people who have done wonderful things in research in dentistry, in medicine, in civil engineering, chemical engineering, and electrical engineering as well. So that makes it a very special award. I want to talk a bit about exactly what we talked about today is broadband wireless and changing the bandwidth paradigm, because that's basically what most of our research is focused on.
What do you mean by changing a bandwidth paradigm?
Changing the bandwidth paradigm is that the focus now is on letting many users use the same bandwidth time space all at the same time and in the same bandwidth, and letting them interfere with each other, and then finding clever ways in the signal processing to cancel out the signals that we don't want, rather than giving dedicated pieces of spectrum to individual users, as, for example, was the case when people gave individual licenses for frequency to veterinarians or cab drivers or whatever.
Well, you know, I don't think I'm ever going to look at cell phones the same. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Norman Beaulieu, a professor in electrical and computer engineering at the University of Alberta. He holds both ICOR and Canada Research Chairs in Broadband Wireless Communications, and he's this year's recipient of the Gordon Kaplan Award for Research Excellence at the University of Alberta. Long gone are the days when the majestic bull trout ruled the rippling waters that pour down the Rocky Mountains onto the prairies. So diminished are the bull trout populations, fishing regulations prohibit you from keeping one should you have the rare occurrence to catch one. Mike Roedke is a fisheries biologist with the Alberta Conservation Association in Rocky Mountain House. He's just finished a study on bull trout in the Clearwater River. And Mike actually has a bit of good news to report.
Well, the Clearwater River is located in west central Alberta. It has its headwaters in Banff National Park, kind of southwest of Rocky Mountain House. The importance of the Clearwater River for bull trout provincially is it's been identified as a location where fisheries management would like to monitor bull trout population levels. And there has been a fair amount of historical work done in the area.
What is the concern about bull trout?
Well, in general, bull trout populations were observed to decline quite precipitously in a lot of areas in Alberta, including the Clearwater River, and it really become a species of concern to a lot of fisheries management, being Alberta's provincial fish, native char. There was a lot of concern that the numbers and the numbers were declining, and also distributions were really contracting.
And actually, in the mid-1990s, it was so serious that regulations were put in so that you couldn't even catch bull trout anymore.
Well, certainly you could catch them, but you couldn't keep them in 1995. Yeah, it was strictly catch and release for bull trout province-wide.
So the study you've been doing over the last couple of years, what exactly were you doing?
The Alberta Conservation Association went in to reassess this population in 2004, was our field season. What we did is we went in and we worked on the main stem river itself, the Clearwater River, as well as some of the larger stream tributaries in the area, to go in, try and evaluate the population numbers, distribution, size structure of bull trout within that area.
How did you actually do that?
Well, we primarily did electrofishing, both in the main stem river on a boat electrofisher, as well as the tributary streams with backpack electrofisher. We also augmented some of that work with some red surveys where we were trying to document bull trout spawning in the area.
What are reds?
a lot of salmonids dig what we call reds, which are essentially nests for deposition of the eggs within the substrate of the streams. And bull trout being fairly large upon maturity, they clear these areas and they're readily observable from the bank. You can see these cleared patches in the fall of nice clean gravel where they deposit their eggs.
You've just finished writing up the analysis of the field study. What is it that you found?
Well, we had a number of interesting findings from this work. Looking at the population within the river, so these are the larger adult fish, we actually were able to get population estimates at two of our study reaches, which that's the first time that there were actually sufficient numbers to get a solid population estimate. So that's quite encouraging, looking like numbers are up. Also, we found larger fish. We were documenting larger sizes of bull trout within the river itself. Again, a really encouraging sign that these fish are able to mature and get to a large size. When we looked at distributions, we really didn't find any evidence of an increasing distribution, which is something we'd like to see to start talking about recovery of this population, but certainly it's early days yet. Looking at the tributary streams, there again, we found our catch per unit effort comparing that was comparable or higher at most of the tributary streams that we surveyed in 2004. And we were also documenting some larger fish in various tributaries too. So really positive signs there.
Was there any indication that the bull trout were going back into streams where perhaps they hadn't been seen for a while?
Well, certainly touching upon the red survey component of this study, that was really exciting in that we located bull trout spawning activity in a stream, in a local stream that really hadn't been used very much at all previously, but where it was suspected historically there was a fairly significant bull trout spawning run. So we would really see this as a positive sign for the Clearwater population.
Well, your study indicates that good things are happening for the bull trout, but what does that mean in terms of their overall population? Is it a significant increase, or are they still at risk?
Well, number one is it's a little bit hard to answer that question because even in the case of the Clearwater population, where we have a fairly extensive historical data set going back to the 70s, nevertheless, we really don't know what that population looked like prior to a number of the factors being introduced in that area that we know impact those populations. So things like non-native species introductions, sport fish like your brown trout or brook trout, different industrial activities in the area, recreational fishing pressure. So we just don't have a real solid handle on what that population might have looked like prior to these factors. So that being said, although things are encouraging and positive, it's really early yet to be saying that this population is recovered by any means.
So they're not out of the woods yet.
No, that's a great way of putting it.
Now that your study is done, what recommendations are you going to make?
Well, generally speaking, with the work we do, we'll present this information to fisheries management, and ultimately it'll be up to them to draw their conclusions from the data that we present to them. Certainly, I like to call it cautiously optimistic about the Clearwater population. But yeah, ultimately it will be fisheries management that draws the solid conclusions from this work.
What do you like about the bull trout?
Oh, they're a fascinating fish. I've actually done some of my graduate research on the bull trout. They're perfectly adapted to RE slope streams. They're a voracious feeder. If you're an angling person, they're a lot of fun to catch. They grow to quite a good size in a lot of our streams. They're just a tremendous fish from any way, behaviorally, even looking at them. A lot of people might not be aware, but the spawning runs that the bull trout will undertake, these migrations, in a lot of senses, they're very much comparable to the runs we see our Pacific salmon, and it's great to see these great big fish in these small streams digging their reds. It's just incredible.
Thank you very much, Mike.
Well, thank you.
That was Mike Roedke, a fisheries biologist with the Alberta Conservation Association in Rocky Mountain House. During the winter, many lakes in Alberta become so low in oxygen, the fish actually die. Corey Rasmussen is a habitat biologist with the Alberta Conservation Association at Rocky Mountain House, and he's involved in a project designed to save these fish.
We have a number of lakes throughout the province. We have 15 water bodies that we do currently aerate and manage. They are located up in the northwest regions of Alberta. We have a few near Rocky Mountain House, one near Edson, near Blairmore, and also Red Deer.
Why do you want to aerate these lakes?
Basically, these lakes are aerated to allow for the fish to overwinter, to survive over winter. The lakes that we aerate are generally susceptible to winter kill, so the dissolved oxygen levels are insufficient for rainbow trout to survive over the winter.
Now, why is that? Are they shallow lakes?
Each individual lake, of course, has its own character. The lakes are susceptible to winter kill just due to, vegetative matter within the water body that decomposes throughout the winter. Peak times, generally around January, February, where the biological oxygen demand increases. So during that time, snow accumulation on the ice can result in decreased photosynthesis. The photosynthesis decrease results in vegetative die-off, and the microbes basically consume the vegetation, and these microbes consume oxygen as well. So they compete, in essence, for dissolved oxygen with the trout species.
Now, if these trout are being stocked anyway, why worry about it? Why not just put new ones in the spring?
This is a tactic, actually, that is used quite often. Is more of a put-and-take fishery. Put-and-take fishery, of course, it is stocking annually, and then basically people come in and remove the surplus. And it's stocked annually. They may winter kill annually, or they may not. But in order to optimize our efficiency of the program, we aerate these water bodies so that the fish do survive, so thus reducing the number of fish introductions that we need to have. And also it maximizes the fish size, the growth potential for the lake and for Alberta anglers.
Well, you're doing the aeration through the winter to ensure that these fish do survive. What do the aeration units actually look like?
Well, we use a mechanical surface aeration unit. There's a 3x3 float that we have on the surface of the water. Inside, embedded in the float, we have a motor with a propeller on it. This propeller sits underneath about 6 inches beneath the surface of the water and spins, throws the water up into the air. It bounces off a small deflector on the aerator unit that creates these tiny droplets of water. And the tiny droplets of water acquire or gain oxygen and fall back down to the surface of the water, thus adding oxygen to the water.
Well, you'd think that the lake would freeze right over.
Well, actually, the movement of the water within this area, the area that we call the polynya, it creates this open area of water, and the constant circulation does keep the water open in that immediate area. There is a tendency for ice to further encroach upon the aerator, and generally, if it's not extremely cold, it won't encapsulate the aerator.
How do you keep it working?
Basically, we have electrical power going to these units. We have also used generators, a diesel-powered generator, in order to operate these units. Underneath the water, we'll start on the shore. We have a generator shed or an aeration shed that contains the electrical components that we need to power these units. A cord passes through the shed underneath the water on the substrate of the water body, and then goes up to the aerator. And that's basically how we continue to power these things. We take a look at, or we monitor these units throughout the aeration period during the winter. We go out there about twice a month in order to just to make sure that these aerators continue to operate and, well, we don't have any potential to lose fish due to lack of oxygen.
Do you do any monitoring during this period?
We do. There's a couple levels of monitoring that we do do. It's one level of monitoring is dissolved oxygen, so DO levels we call it. The other level of monitoring, we tend to monitor the trout population itself. We take a look at growth. For the dissolved oxygen monitoring, well, we go out onto these water bodies a few times a year, a few times a winter, and take dissolved oxygen samples just to ensure that the DO levels are adequate for rainbow trout survival. We have several locations on the water body that we do the sampling from in order to identify whether or not we're reaching dissolved oxygen requirements throughout the water body. For monitoring fish, we work in cooperation with Alberta Sustainable Resource Development. We go out and do some test netting. And this we utilize gill nets, but we monitor them on a very frequent basis. So we're going around the lake from net to net, removing the fish, putting them into a live well, measuring them, taking weights, and then returning them to the water body. So there is no real kill of fish during these activities.
It sounds like an awful lot of work. Is it worthwhile doing this aeration on these lakes?
As far as cost-benefit analysis goes, we take a look at the cost that we are putting into this. Much of the dollars that we actually put into these projects come from partnership funding. So we acquire funding through applications that we put into industry, members of the public, and also funds that do actually come from the licenses of hunters and fishermen of Alberta. We have taken a look at the cost-benefit analysis of this, and we found that the benefit really does override the cost. It brings in a lot of people to local areas, brings people into establishments to, say, such as hotels, restaurants, local angling supply stores, fuel, etc., than for people coming into these water bodies to angle.
Thank you very much, Corey.
Thank you very much.
That was Corey Rasmussen, a habitat biologist with the Alberta Conservation Association in Rocky Mountain House. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our weekly newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the Alberta Conservation Association, ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, Alberta Research Council, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, Calgary Technologies, Inc., the University of Lethbridge, Alberta Gaming Research Institute, Alberta Innovation and Science, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, Science Alberta Foundation, Ducks Unlimited Canada, and the NSERC ACR Integrated Landscape Management Research Chair. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.